Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Data Revolution podcast. I'm sorry it's been a while. Work got in the way and some travel, but I've been talking a lot about AI while I've been away and thinking about it too. So I thought I would just run through where my thinking is at right now. And the thing that I'm going to really start with is my favorite law, which is Amara's law, which is, and I quote, "We tend to overestimate the effect of a technology in the short run and underestimate the effect in the long run." Roy Amara, go Google him. He's got a good way of thinking about these things. Now, AI will change everything we thought we knew about technology and business, and we are facing one of the biggest revolutions that we've ever faced. And AI will drive it, but I think we're kind of underestimating the long-term impacts and overestimating the short-term impacts. I'm going to talk a bit about that in a minute. But first, I really want to just go back to what do we mean by AI? Because I hear a lot of people talking about AI as if it's just generative AI, which I think it will become increasingly, but it's all quite new. And if we go right back to one of the guys who invented the concept of AI, John McCarthy, who was there in 1956 when the whole concept was invented. And he literally said, and I quote again, "It is the science and engineering of making intelligent machines, especially intelligent computer programs. It is related to the similar task of using computers to understand human intelligence. But AI does not have to confine itself to methods that are biologically observable," unquote. So artificial intelligence is kind of an umbrella term. And when we really talk about AI, what we are talking about is some combination of the things that I'm going to talk about now. So there's machine learning, which is really a subset of AI that enables machines to learn from existing data and then improve upon the data to drive decision making. That was only invented in 1997 for many of us living memory. Deep learning is the next thing, which is a machine learning technique where layers of neural networks are used to process data and make decisions. That was invented in 2012. And then we've got generative AI, which is the new kid on the block, which was 2021, which is about creating new visual, written, and video and auditory content given prompts or existing data. And that's still evolving, and we don't even know what that's going to look like. And I really think that many of you will be familiar with the Gartner hype cycles. And I looked at the last Gartner hype cycle, which was July 2023. So a year ago, and it's got generative AI just at the peak of inflated expectations. And I predict that we're going to slide over into what they call the trough of disillusionment before we can move up the slope of enlightenment and the plateau of productivity. And I'll share this in the show notes. I think everybody's been running around madly with generative AI. I kind of think it's almost like teenage sex. A lot of people are talking about it, hardly anyone's actually doing it. And I think the next couple of years are where we are going to be doing all of the hard work about how we can actually use this in a business and organizational context to deliver on our organizational missions, to deliver return on investment, and how to make sensible and safe investments in it. So I think we're very early in the cycle. And one thing that I will say, though, that generative AI has the shortest adoption curve for any new technology that I've ever seen. I've been knocking around the technology industry for a long time, and I'm part of a global chief data officers group, and we meet around about every 6 months. We met late last year. Everybody there was going, "I'm really not sure what it is, how we're going to use it." Met in February this year, and everybody at least had a proof of concept in production. So the shortest, and this included banks. And if you've ever tried to get anything through a bank, you know how short that adoption curve is. So really an astonishing adoption curve, but I still don't think we know what we're going to use it for, how we're going to use it, and how we're going to do that safely and preserve privacy as well. So I'm starting to see news articles where people are talking about how it's a bit overhyped, how generative AI is a bit overhyped. So I really think that is true. But on the other hand, you know, the managing director of the International Monetary Fund actually came out in January this year and said AI will transform the global economy. and predicted that it will affect almost 40% of jobs around the world. Now, that might be an underestimate, but one of the things that's really clear is that we actually need to start to think very carefully about how we're going to deploy this technology and what jobs we're going to replace and how we're going to keep humans in the loop, because there are real dangers to having AI running unoperated without accountability. So this is where we need to start to determine what our race is, so our who's responsible and who's accountable for AI, and start to get that clear in our heads. And in thinking about it as a sort of a timeline of technology, if you sort of imagine that this is the start of the next generation, so let's imagine that imagine back in the day when Netscape came out, and we're now in the age of TikTok. So Netscape was a long time ago. I think we're in the Netscape era for AI, and or we could say even the Ask Jeeves, the old search engine that we used to use, one of them. So we're in the super early days of this technology, and we're not even able to predict where we will go, because who's sitting there thinking about the future when Netscape was the only way we had for our accessing the internet could have imagined that things like TikTok would exist. But I want to sudden just shift to talk about how I think generative AI will be really useful in the future, because I've been thinking about this a fair bit. And I see it as something that will start to transform the user interface. I see it as being the genuinely revolutionary technology that is going to transform user interfaces. So we are going to be able to talk to a generative AI interface, and it will go off and do things for us. If you ask it, it will be able to go and play your favorite song because it will have context. So I'm predicting that generative AI, large language models, LLMs, will get smaller and will get more personal. So I'm predicting that we will have them on our telephones, on our smartphones, and on our laptops and other devices, and they will be highly personalized to us. They'll be private to us. They won't be going out and sharing that information out on the general internet. And they'll get to know us. So when you ask your LLM, your personal LLM, to play your favorite song, it'll actually understand your context because it's on your phone. It'll know you where you are. It'll know what level you're on, what level in the building you're on, because your phone's got an accelerometer. It will know what you've been doing. It'll know what you've been doing beforehand because it's got access to your calendar as well as possibly your conversations. And it'll know what kind of mood you're in because of all of that context that it will have available to it. It'll be able to play your favorite song. So that kind of specific contextual awareness that you cannot get from a normal program because it's super hard to get will suddenly become available to us eventually. And I was talking with my friend Mark Pesci earlier this year about how LLMs were going to get smaller. And the next day we were sharing an article, a research article that is titled "The Era of One-Bit LLMs." All large language models are in 1.58 bits. So almost overnight in February, we were talking about it and it had happened. So one of the things that I think about this space of AI is, if there's anything that you're trying to imagine, there's research happening on making it real right now. And the other thing that was quite funny, I was saying to a friend, "Oh, but they don't know anything about time series." And then I found a research article about time LLM, which is time series forecasting by reprogramming large language models. So everything that you're thinking of, there is somebody trying to work on it right now, or have already worked on it, and you just don't know about it. Try asking an LLM to find it for you. But one thing that's become clear to me is that hallucination is not going to go away. And it does seem to be an innate limitation of large language models. I think we're going to be able to program around it, but for the time being, large language models do hallucinate, and that will become remain a thing. And what that means is that we can't trust them to do things that need facts delivered reliably. So we're actually going to have to stitch together our technology by using LLMs at the front end, but stitching together fact bases and knowledge bases to deliver that. And that means we're not getting rid of our programmers or data engineers anytime soon. All of this has implications, and everything is going to change. So how we do all of the things, and just to give you an idea of all of the things, and this is not a comprehensive list, but it's going to change agriculture, art and the arts, cyber and information security, education and learning, environment, health and medical, home and household, manufacturing, media and entertainment, military and war, science and technology, sex and sex work, shopping, travel and transport, work and jobs, because work and jobs are inherent in all of those things. So that's not a comprehensive list, but it's just a bunch of stuff that I can think of off the top of my head. And probably the one that I think is the most intriguing is how it's going to change education and learning, and also military and war. Now, education and learning is interesting, and I'll be doing a series of podcast episodes about that. But if we just think, if the teachers are using AI to create assessments, and the students are using AI to do the assessments, and then the teachers are using AI to mark the assessments, why do the assessments exist? So I think we have some thinking to do in the education and learning space, and it's a big issue, and I'm going to get some interesting folks on to talk about that. And also military and war. And I think it's really been fascinating watching how Ukraine have been rewriting how you fight a war, especially a naval war, in front of us using drones. So they have basically chased the Russian Navy out of the Black Sea using drone technology, and they've used drone technology really in interesting ways on the land too. And I think it's very telling that Eric Schmidt, the former Google CEO, is moved in a big way into the AI attack drone space. So military technology is very much going to be driven by AI right now. So that's just a couple of things to keep an eye on, but it's going to change everything. However, one thing that I can perceive is a whole lot of streams are going to be merging. So there's AI and data, Internet of Things, robotic process automation and services, digital twins and tokenization, and quantum computing. Now, they all seem to be like different things, but I believe that they're all converging and merging into a world of autonomous systems. And that's where I think AI is going in a really interesting direction. And that is something that I think we should all keep our eye on. So, yes, AI is the big flavor of the month at the moment, but when it merges and converges with all of these other things, I think really interesting things are going to happen. And I think they're going to be autonomous systems, which will be fun. But it means that we need to start thinking about certain things as we move from AI towards autonomous systems. We need to start to consider things like agency, like, what degree of agency or empowerment do we give to autonomous systems? Like, do we let them run around on their own, or do we have humans in the loop? Autonomy, how do we think about the idea of autonomy, and how do we build for it? And how do we work out who's accountable for the actions of an autonomous system? That's one that the lawyers will play with for a while, I suspect. And then there's the issue of interfaces, because all of the interesting problems with technologies are all at the interfaces. And we have been talking about an API-driven world for a long time, but it hasn't really come to pass. But I suspect we're on the cusp of it becoming real. But how we might interface with technology systems and each other in this context will be really interesting. And then also, how do we assure ourselves that these systems are safe? And then how do we assure people that that has happened will be a real issue, I believe. And the other thing is the intentionality of these systems, because the intended purpose and meaning of a system is what it does. And that may not always be immediately apparent to the people building the system. So I think that'll be an interesting thing to keep an eye on. And then really, what metrics are we going to measure the success of these systems? So these were the things that we need to start thinking about now. So the same way that, like, 5 or 6 years ago, I was talking about how we need to sort out ethics because AI is coming. I'm saying we need to answer these kind of questions because we need to start to think about this for the future, and it's not that far away. And then the other thing I'm going to touch on is jobs and work. In the immediate future, I'm really seeing computer-enabled human interaction and a lot of removing of friction in processes by automating them. So a bit of robotic process automation, better bots at the front end, stuff like that, and really trying to shift people from process work, automating routine repetitive tasks. But jobs will go. I've been saying for some time, if you work in a call center, find another job. That's the first one that will go. But as usual, as I've been telling people for a number of years, the two job areas for the future are data and cyber. That doesn't change. But there will be new jobs emerging, and we can't predict what they were. And I do remind everybody that the job I had now did not exist when I left high school, and there was no way you could have trained me for it. So let's not panic about that. But new jobs will emerge. But at the end of the day, generative AI is not going to be able right now to build our engineering team, to do the work of our engineering team. It might be able to help our engineering teams, but it's not going to be able to replace them. So we're still going to need data engineers and coders and data scientists and programmers to put it together. And assembling all the data and pulling all the data together that we need is not going to be easy. And one of the things that organizations need to be starting to think about is, I think in the past we've all thought about our structured data and managed our structured data and thought about that as the valuable set of data that the organization holds. Increasingly now, with generative AI and other AI technologies, our unstructured data will become much richer and be able to be incorporated much more easily. So one of the things that I'm recommending for organizations is you need to get control of both your structured and your unstructured data. You need to know what you have, know what you hold, know where it is, know how it's secured. You also need to understand where you hold personal information, any sensitive or highly sensitive data, and to be able to put sensitivity labels on that so that you can exclude it from your AI results. And that's going to be a lot of work. So this all leads us into the need to ensure that our data is protected. And I speak as a person who has been in every major data breach. I'm even in the big US telco one that just got announced the other day. I'm feeling very put upon, but I seriously might as well have put my passport on the internet since I'm in all of these data breaches. But data protection becomes a big issue for organizations now. So we need to make sure that we are collecting data that we have a lawful reason to collect. We need to make sure that we limit the purposes for which we hold it and collect it. So, in short, every organization needs to think about moving from being a data hoarder to be a data minimizer. And we need to make sure that we can maintain the confidentiality and integrity and availability of that data, but most of all, the confidentiality. So, we're going to need to be working with our cyber colleagues. So in the data protection space, we all need to start thinking about our data and AI governance. How are we going to govern AI at scale? And that's a very real issue now. Also, the quality of data. So if our quality of data is not there, then we could be driving poor decision making in the AI space. So we need to start looking at our data inputs and ensuring that data quality is improved. And we need to look at data risk management. So we need to know where our personal information is. We need to be able to apply sensitivity labels so that we can exclude some things from AI data sets. And we need to make sure that we're maintaining our cyber and information security. So need to protect from external threats, need to maintain our confidentiality, integrity, and availability. And then, of course, we need to comply with our privacy obligations, which for global organizations are increasingly onerous and increasingly difficult. To comply with all of them at once is actually quite a big challenge. So, in short, Hallucinations are not going to go away. LLMs are doing exactly what they were developed to do. They respond based on their training data sets to user prompts. They are quite primitive. We are in the Netscape era. We will need to mitigate these hallucinations by the generative AI tools that we will need to pair them with chat fact-checking systems. And we will need leave to make sure we'll need to make sure that we don't leave our chatbots unsupervised. We will need to get clear on what data we're using to drive our AIs, and being really clear about where we put our data so that our data doesn't form part of the training corpus of somebody else's AI. And that means that we need to pay real attention to how we contract with AI-related companies, because we don't want to be giving away rights to data that we may not actually have the right to give away. And we also need to make sure that we can have fair decisions that are transparent and defendable. And so that means we will need to have ways of dealing with ethics and bias checking, which will come down to having human beings in the process. So there's, in short, I think it's super early days for the AI revolution. As I keep saying, we're in the Netscape era. We've got a long way to go. This is a marathon, not a sprint. Focus on the basics and don't panic. Thanks for listening.
And that is it for another episode of the Data Revolution podcast. I'm Kate Crothers. Thank you so much for listening. Please don't forget to give the show a nice review and a like on your podcast app of choice. See you next time.